CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Ted Fox, and it's Saturday, October the 10th, last I checked. Coming up on our show, Amelia Earhart will be, who is a choreographer based in Toronto, talks about her new position as curator of Dance Makers and the vision of Dance Makers for the future and their performance module, etc. And we hope to have on Aaron Poole and Luke Garfield on an upcoming show with them. But first off, we have Taylor Gladhead. Hi.
Hi.
And he's here to talk about Opera Atelier's 30th anniversary season opener of Armide. And that's going to be quite an opener.
It will, yes.
Okay, your background, I first saw you, was in contemporary dance.
Yes.
Supercircle stuff.
Yes.
Okay, how did you get to become a baroque dancer? When did this happen? 8 years ago?
Yeah, it was about 8 years ago. And I heard that Opera Atelier was looking for men, so a friend of mine who was already in the company told me to get in touch and audition, and so I did, and it just, yeah.
Well, Opera Atelier is one of the few companies I see in which there's a lot of men.
There are.
As opposed to so many companies lately, unless it's certain ones, aren't. And why is that, by the way?
Well, I mean,
in the courses, less dancers and...
Yeah, I don't know about other companies. I know Opera Atelier, they always, because it's quite, you know, traditional with court dances and stuff like that, so, you know, every woman has to have a man to be paired with. So there's, you know, it's usually 8 of each or 6 of each, depending on the production. But, yeah, so they have a hard time finding enough men sometimes because there aren't enough of us in the city.
Well, we see.
Yeah.
In some places, like radio shows, et cetera, but they're more in commercial dance, I think.
Right, yes, yeah.
By the way, that attracts people. More commercial dance. It didn't attract you at any point?
No, I do some commercial dance here and there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More, say, money, more economical to be a commercial dancer, probably. Cruise ships, well paid.
Yeah, I guess so. I've never done that, but... No, I mean, I feel like that might get exhausting, though, because you don't really have a home base if you do that. So, I mean, I like to be here in my home in Toronto.
Okay, so when you got on board, Opera Atelier,
yeah.
Did you have any baroque dance background at all?
None.
Okay. What was it like? How did you get trained into?
Well, they were very patient with me. Baroque dance is pretty much the early... evolution of ballet. Like, ballet came out of Baroque dancing. So a lot of the, you know, it's, you know, you're turned out, you're walking on your on the balls of the feet. There's a lot of similarities. So if you have ballet technique, it helps to be able to pick up the Baroque dancing. So they were very patient with me, but, you know, there are a lot of different arm positions and a few feet movements and stuff that are they seem just, you know, I don't want to say opposite of what balletic would be, but they're just, you know, it's just a new way of thinking and training, and so it does help to have the ballet technique, though.
What you just said, immediately an image came into my mind of you, because I do notice you out there and doing leaps, really high leaps.
Yes.
Or turtles or movements or kicks, and I thought that's very interesting.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. And how hard is it on challenging on the body as opposed to, say, contemporary and others? Is it?
It is. It's like I would say it's harder on the body in a different way. You know, like doing big jumps and stuff is always, you know, it's mm-hmm. you feel it in your knees, you feel it in your back, you know, but luckily I'm trained to do that, so it's not like it's, you know, I'm hurting myself or anything like that. But, you know, you just get a little tired, worn out, and maybe feel it the next day, but that's how it is.
I always see you guys and women as always having a very statuesque, regal posture, like very, like they've been taking Alexander technique, heights,
right.
And movements, you know, like all the way through.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you'll go into the leaps and things that are... I associate with contemporary, but it's
right.
Buried in the technique, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's
yeah.
fun.
Yeah.
How is Jeanette to work with? She's very knowledgeable. My gosh, I think she...
Oh, she knows the technique inside and out.
Years,
yes.
And she's very perfectionist about actually him and taking that sound.
Yeah, and it's quite amazing to see, like, in rehearsals, when she's watching somebody doing something, she can pinpoint the exact movement that they're doing, you know, that's making it harder, you know, like, or that isn't quite realized the way it's supposed mm-hmm. to be. Mm-hmm. Like, she sees it right away. It's kind of amazing. yeah, so she knows exactly what she's talking about.
Right. Yeah. Omid, can you talk a bit about the plot of it?
The plot.
Before we get into the actual...
Okay, well, so it takes place during the Crusades, and Armide is this... well, she's kind of like a sorceress, but she's the, you know, the queen, basically. And she's so stunning that she... had the whole Christian army surrender just by, like, without shedding any blood. Like, they just all bowed to her, and so they were all captured. And so that's how it starts out, is that it's a celebration that this has happened. But then they find out there's this one man, and he's kind of in the prophecy, and she has a dream about him, that this man is going to possibly destroy her. And his name is Renaud, and so in the middle of this celebration, a bloody soldier comes in and says, all of the captives have been released by this one man. Mm-hmm. And so she immediately has to put a plan into motion and summon these spirits, and, well, evil spirits, as well as the spirit of love, to capture this man's heart and confuse him and try to... yeah, but the problem is that love is so powerful, it makes its way into her heart as well. So I won't ruin the end, but that's the twist. It's that she falls in love.
Didn't they do this before?
Yes, we did it three years ago. Yeah, we did it in 2012.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Marsha Bendowski,
yes,
is the director, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he always has a sense of being campy in a lot of his productions, I find. And
really?
He's at a good way, like campy, outrageous. I missed, does that lend itself to that, or would you say this is pretty straightforward?
No, I mean, this one does have, I would say, one or two comedic sort of scenes where...
Mm-hmm. Yes, he's very good at...
Yes, oh yeah, he is, like, you know, like the marriage of Figaro is fantastic.
Very dry.
Yes. But I would say this Armide is just your straight up Baroque opera with... love and passion and tragedy and you know, fiery demons from hell and like all of that. Like, so I would say it's the quintessential just very powerful dramatic opera. I wouldn't say there's any campy aspect to it, or there is that, like, small comedic sort of scene that is, you know, it is a nice little break in the seriousness of the opera. But yeah, for the most part it's very, very dramatic,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which I think is beautiful.
And your movement's all very carefully orchestrated into the choir and into the music, which is
yes.
always live. You should mention that. There's a full orchestra.
Oh, full orchestra. Tafel music.
Tafel music,
yeah.
Which is dynamic.
World-renowned.
Yeah, and I always marvel at how everybody always gets on cue to exactly when, you know, given all the surroundings.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a big... There's so many elements.
Rehearsals to get this ready.
Yes.
To the point where it's automatic.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Costume design, how would you describe it in this one?
Very lavish, bold, beautiful colors, especially for the women. They mm-hmm. all of their dresses are absolutely stunning. Yeah. Just
I find he uses such lavish color as you were that I can almost taste them or drink them.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you just look at the stage, it looks like, you know, a beautiful painting that's come to life. It's just so rich.
That's how Bertelli's work. It's rich in doing that exactly. Also rich in the use of backdrop and
yes.
set. So does this have a stage that changes, or is it automatically changed right in front of your eyes?
This one has quite a few set changes, actually. There are a lot of legs coming in and out, and backdrops, and beautiful lighting design. So it's quite
magical
spectacular.
Thing, like I'm used to seeing something magical coming in the air above the actors, a god appearing.
There isn't this in this production. There aren't any actors flying at all. Mm-hmm. The only thing that I would say like flies in and out is this big ring of fire that is in the scene where Hatred is summoned, mm-hmm. and there he has his kind of henchmen like these fiery demons, spirits that jump through the ring of fire.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah, that so that's pretty cool. That comes
really,
down. And
really, really works well.
Yeah.
And when you're dancing, how does dance work into the piece? Is Jeanette creating dances that weren't original? Is she working with sort of dance that was in the old production? How does this work?
You know what? I'm not actually familiar with the original production of Armide from the day, but I know that Baroque opera traditionally always did have a lot of dance in it and ballet. Mm-hmm. So there are entire scenes where we are dancing to just music and it's not singing. So that, I mean, that tells me that probably was composed to have dance there because, you know, otherwise the there'd be an empty stage with nobody singing, and that would be a little strange. So I'm actually quite certain that Jeanette is very true to what the original was. Although it's her choreography, mm-hmm. it is the Baroque style, and it's you know the original story mm-hmm. for sure.
Now, what other backgrounds do the dancers? The other dancers have? Do they all come from contemporary? I know one we had on. She seemed to be a Baroque dancer from an early age, and also was in the
yes.
choir of her
production. Oh yes. No, she's actually she's also a singer too. So she's in Stratford right now. Oh. But so most of the dancers in the company have classical training. Mm-hmm. Went to ballet schools. A few have gone to Ryerson for the contemporary dance program. Mm-hmm. In general, you do need to have a certain level of ballet technique to be able to do Baroque dance, mm-hmm. Because it is using external rotation in the hips and pointed feet and just things, you know, that sort of finesse that comes with ballet training.
Mm-hmm. They probably enjoy it. They probably want to go everywhere in it, right? It's,
right, yeah.
It's different.
Yes, oh, absolutely.
You probably look forward to it every year.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah.
Okay, now this takes place at the Elgin Theater.
It does.
Well, I don't know what time is that. I think it's 7.
7:30.
7:30.
Yes. For most, yes. Most shows are 7:30. Mm-hmm. I believe we have one Sunday matinee that'll be 3:00, and then the closing Saturday, which will be October 31st, will be at 4:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm. And do you like working in the Elgin?
I do. It's a beautiful theater. It's stunning.
It's really it's got a good view practically anywhere.
That's true, yeah.
Okay. Go to Opera Atelier, that's ATELIER.com, and you'll get all the box office information and buying tickets and everything else on there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And thanks, Taylor, for coming on Evidence.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Evidence here on CIUT 89.5 FM. There we are.
All right. Great.
Cool.
Right here, right now. Every day, CIUT 89.5. The sound of your city. Toronto. Did you know there are now 8 different ways in which you can listen to your favorite programs on CIUT? From Barrie to Buffalo, Kitchener to Coburg, you can pick us up on 89.5 FM. We also stream online at www.ciut.fm, on Rogers Digital Cable, Channel 946, Channel 970 on Bell 5 TV, Star Choice Satellite offers CIUT on Channel 826, and you can pick us up on the TuneIn Radio app and under College and Campus Radio on iTunes. Finally, you can listen or download CIUT program archives at CIUT.fm. CIUT 89.5 FM, delivering the new sound of your city everywhere. Thank you.
welcome back to Evidence on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Ted Fox. Well, from Baroque dance, we are now going to dance makers. And Amelia Earhart, are you there, Amelia?
Yeah, here I am.
Yikes. Boy, you're like a mega loud there.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yep, now you're getting normal. You sound normal now.
I have no explanations. I'm in a cabin in the woods right now, so I would have thought it would have been
Oh, my God,
here.
Where?
I'm at my family's cottage for Thanksgiving, just outside of in Gooderham, Ontario, just outside of Halliburton.
Oh God! If you watch too many horror movies, you get what? So I don't know what's happening here. I'm getting pointed at. Okay, Cabin in the Woods. When you say that, it reminds me of a horror movie, Cabin in the Woods. So hey,
this is
don't get out, don't walk out anywhere alone.
No,
okay.
This is my favorite place in the world.
Okay. First, and very briefly on this, because I want to get right into the subject matter as such, what led you and attracted you to get into dance? To become a dancer or become involved with dance.
Well, I started dancing quite late, especially for somebody who makes a career of it, and especially for a woman, but yeah. I was 14 when I started taking dance class. I'd always been involved in art, especially performing arts. I'd played clarinet for a long time, and I was a drama major at the Etobicoke School of the Arts, and I had always been really attracted to dance, but when I was a kid, we didn't really have enough money to put me in dance class, so when I was a teenager, things were a bit different. I got put in ballet class and just got really obsessed with it, and it kind of took over my life, but I guess for me, it really fit a lot of the things that attracted me to the performing arts and to theater, but theater wasn't a really good fit for me. There were a lot of things about the form that I didn't like, and I really liked, I think I really took to certainly the athleticism of dance. I come from a lot of athletes, but also the mystery, the mm-hmm. abstraction are things that really kept me in it.
Right.
It's just, it's a form that you really have to work to pin down, and I think that even as a teenager, I was really interested in trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Now, part of your background includes curating, producer of, I guess, the inaugural dance series in Summerworks, and mm-hmm. also admin director of CATA.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into curation? Was this through your experiences at Flowchart? Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, for sure. So Flowchart was something that I started. It's a multidisciplinary series of performance that I started in 2013, so quite recently. I got into that. It was sort of funny. I was at Impulse Tons and having a really funny time. I wasn't really liking any of the shows that I saw. And I was getting kind of homesick and thinking about the people I knew who were making performance in Toronto and a bit nostalgic for it and also wishing for a space for the performance that's getting made to be shown together and certainly to be shown in the context of dance where things can be a little isolated. And I actually started that series because I had a solo that I had made and I wanted to self-present it, but I didn't want to self-present a 20-minute solo as a standalone piece. So I put it in a series, sort of like looked at the verb of what I was doing. Okay, I curated the series. I called it curation, and it really just took off. I did a flowchart in at Summerworks that year as well. So this was last year. Oh, no, it wasn't 2013. It was 2014 that I started it. Yeah, this was just last year, and then I did one mm-hmm. at Summerworks in 2014, and then another one, Ben and Emmy, the now outgoing curators at Dance Makers, invited me to do one as a season opener in just January of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was invited to come aboard as the curating producer of the inaugural dance series at Summerworks. So it was something that I got into a little bit out of both a desire for finding a place for my own work to fit somewhere, specifically, I would say, in this ecology in Toronto, but also out of a desire to just, you know, make a space for the kind of work that I wanted to see existing
mm-hmm.
To exist.
Because the very word curating means selecting according to your tastes and probably your individual politics too, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. It definitely has that in it. The word itself has roots in the word custodian, which is, I think, a nice reminder for people working in curation all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, congratulations again about being appointed with Dance Makers.
Thank you very much.
And Can you talk a bit about the history of Dance Makers? How long has it been Dance Makers, and can you just elaborate till now to say Michael Trent, what's been happening up until now?
What's been happening up until
through Dance Maker, like the type of work and choreographer's approach to choreography that's been happening up till the point now where Ben Camino and came into the process.
For sure. So Dance Makers started 40 years ago. I can't remember the exact year now, but it started about 40 years ago, and it was really started. What I'm always struck by when I think about the history of Dance Makers is that it really comes from a kind of artist-run history.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of started as a space for, I think initially they were York students, to come together and make work. And so it had a history in that kind of perspective, and ran for a long time with a number of different artistic directors. I know Carol Anderson at one point had been the artistic director, which is a nice thing for me because I danced in her work as sort of one of the like first things that I did in my life. And then for a very long time, Serge Benetton, who was the artistic director, and this was sort of right before Michael Trent, which was the stopping point that you asked me to get up to.
And Michael Trent was the last, but it was veering towards this new process about Michael Trent, the end of his duet.
Yeah, for sure. So up until that point, this whole history that I'm trying very hard to succinctly encapsulate was always under a model of artistic directorship and sort of repertoire on a company. So previously it had been like a split focus, multiple artistic director thing. And then under Serge, and again, under Michael, it was more of a single vision.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of his tenure, Michael moved towards shifting the company to being this model called an incubation performance house. So this is what where we're currently standing, where instead of having an artistic director who was, you know, a resident choreographer who works on company dancers, it's now an incubation performance house where we house multiple resident artists who are working on different projects with different collaborators. And instead of an artistic director who also makes work for the company, it's shifted to being a curator who doesn't make work for the company, but who selects the resident artists, programs ancillary programming, and makes those kinds of artistic decisions.
This, I guess, model was developed in Europe quite a while back, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's...
Because Montreal latched on it before, like, now in Toronto, I'm hearing more of it.
Yeah, so I would say it's not a new model in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I would say that it's not even a new model in Toronto, but it's I really believe in it as a model that's reflective of how the sector works now, that's reflective of the way artists are already working, and offers space for artists to continue working in that way.
Mm-hmm. Am I right in saying that the residency, the work that's developed there, I guess, and the choreographed, is presented in one place as opposed to what we've had in the past? You're creating on site and you're performing and performing to the public on site.
Well, the resident artists are working on site, and we've so far done our showings here, but we're also in conversation with presenters outside of Toronto, outside of our own walls, and working to get the work outside of those places.
Right.
It's something that we're trying to build more networks as well.
Okay.
And for the work to have a life outside of just the residency period.
So, in this process, I guess it's like a community. It all comes together and shares and creating a piece, and then even, I guess, some of the members become outside eyes on the piece as well. How does this whole sharing and developing pieces as a collective work?
It's not really...
Nope.
The works aren't really developed as a collective. It's still all the artists that we have working are working as pretty much as single authors. A lot of the choreographers often work like really in relationship with the other artists and in collaboration with them. But I would say that our three resident artists that we have right now, Zoya Smutny, Dana Michelle, and upcoming Anthony Hamilton, who will be incoming this year, they all certainly like propose to work as, and then are sort of the main, I would say the sort of main voice in the works.
Yeah.
Zoya certainly works in really close collaboration with the people who are involved in the project. And I know that the dancers are really present and important voices in Dana's work. Anthony's work I don't know very well, so I don't know what kind of collaboration he works in, but it's I don't know that I would call their processes explicitly collaborative in that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's what I was curious about, because when I hear people talking about it, there's certain things like the choreographers say, like Dana Michelle, right?
Dana Michelle.
Yeah, what I admire her for, like so many, is their individual voice, their individual way of expression. So mm-hmm. I was worried that, because I thought of this as a more of a community, as I mentioned the word before, and I guess I'm wrong there. As long as the choreographer gets her, what she's doing, it is a piece of hers, but shaped by the group into a piece.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that this is, again, reflective of how things are really happening, that by and large choreographers are really open to the fact that the performers in the work they're the people who can give you the most information about the work in a certain way, because they're the ones enacting it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely been a shift towards putting a bit more, I would say, conceptual power in the hands of performers and acknowledging their perspective as being a really important one.
So it's a sort of rethinking of dance as an art form, then.
There's
in the process and everything. So how, I guess what I want to mention here to me is, how is this working to get the public more involved in dance? Amy Henderson has, I know, she works a lot in breaking down the barriers between audience, but I mean, the last experience I had, it was more like not only breaking barriers, but the audience becomes part of the piece. So you're doing a lot of things here, audience participation, getting more involved, because so many people I talk are still trying to get them to go and see dance. They assume that dance is, and I'm going to use a word I think I read somewhere that you hate, is too cerebral and inaccessible, and it's like another language to them, and they just can't get into it. The other mm-hmm. aspect, because of So You Think You Can Dance and others, is a lot want dance to be an entertainment, and I'm mm-hmm. finding it very difficult to get those people to see some pieces like this and get them maybe, hey, well, this is going on, but I mm-hmm. can't seem to get them.
Mm-hmm.
So any comments on all that, if I made any sense there?
No, you made a lot of sense. I mean, this is just a huge
problem.
I'll call it a problem.
Right.
In and around contemporary dance is that, this is my perspective on it, that contemporary dance, really, we want a wider audience. But we don't know, we're not necessarily reaching out to the right people to be those audience.
Mm-hmm.
I think people often assume that people who have some interaction with dance already, so people who go to the ballet, people who watch So You Think You Can Dance, that would be, you know, potential audience for contemporary dance.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's not. I think that in a lot of cases, the contemporary dance audience are people who are going to the AGO, you know, people who are in grad programs, people who follow contemporary theory, like these kinds of worlds that are intersecting with contemporary dance more, or with which contemporary dance is intersecting, as sort of fields that are interested in similar things. I think that those are areas where we can be looking for a new audience for contemporary dance, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Reaching them is really hard, and I think one of the problems, I don't know, you said this thing about how, you know, people want dance to be sort of an entertainment value thing.
Yeah.
They come from So You Think You Can Dance, yeah. Or even certainly, like, in a lot of cases, an audience for something like the ballet, which has so much capacity to be spectacular.
Mm.
But then I think on the other hand, a lot of people who are interested in contemporary art might think of dance as being that, might think of dance as being something that's really based on a lot of entertainment, something that's about the spectacular, something that is about athleticism, and maybe isn't to their taste either. So I think it's finding people who are already interested in what contemporary dance is working on and saying, hey, maybe you don't know that this is what contemporary dance looks like now, but this is what it looks like now.
Yeah.
So come on over.
So, yeah. I'm thinking of words like mediating between the dance community and the general public. And as you're talking, I get an image of someone in a lineup to TIFF talking about, is this film entertaining? I don't want to see a film that's entertaining. And these international cinemas are just too intellectual and inaccessible. So it's more than just dance, I guess, given this economic and circumstances of the society we live in. There's a lot of people, because everything's getting more expensive, want to go out, but mm-hmm. they want to be sure that they're going to get something that they're going to like, and it's too dicey to try this risk when you are limited funding. There's so much involved in this, isn't there?
It's really complicated. I know I worked at the ballet for a lot of years. I'm actually just with this job, I'm leaving this whole position, and it was always remarkable to me to watch ballet audiences. I had this job working a fundraising kiosk in Staten, sort of standing in the lobby and really interacting with the largest dance audience in Toronto, and I would look at them and be like, what do you want? What are you here for? What are you interested in? And it was so interesting how people, I guess I'm just so used to the risk of putting money down on a performance and not knowing if you're going to like it, that I don't think about that anymore. That's sort of I feel like once you're used to it, you understand that that's the contract you're entering, that you're paying this money to see something that you don't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. What a surprise. And I think a lot of people expect this really complicated word, expect this kind of value from the money that they paid for their ticket.
That's right.
And if the show isn't what they were expecting, then they feel somehow ripped off. But that's a translation issue that I just don't know. I don't know what to do about. I'll let you know in a couple of years if I have any more insight on that. But I sure don't right now.
I just thought of something else. To those who read books, some read crime novels, some will read Charles Dickens, some will go into more experimental or that. So it's basically the same, similar thing. Their likes or dislikes determine what they read. How many other artist-run spaces are working now in Toronto in which art comes first? Qualify?
That's a tricky question. I mean, Canadian Art Magazine just or is it C Magazine? I'm mixing them up right now. But one of these magazines just put out a big article on artist-run centers, and they interview a lot of different artist runs. This is a visual art audience in a visual art market, but they're interviewing all of these different artist runs. They ask them the sort of extremely reductive question. Are artist run centers still relevant? So there's a bit of reading that could be done about this topic. If you check that out, I know they interview 811 and a number of other art collectives and artist run spaces in Toronto. But so that being said, across disciplines, there are tons of artist run spaces. There are tons of spaces that are operated by artists. Dance makers, I wouldn't call explicitly an artist-run center. You know, we're at the moment run by people who are artists, but it's different than an artist-run. How many artist runs are there? I don't know.
I was thinking of the idea of where the dancer or the choreographer, the artist, whatever, you know, has some degree of, I guess, creation. Yeah.
Well, I guess the line on that can be quite wide. Like, if we're talking about spaces where a choreographer or an artist is the person who has a lot of control over the situation, then innumerable situations. Because every time you're talking about a process where somebody's making decisions, then that's that. But once you start getting into funded institutions, then that lowers a bit. But there's still quite a lot of spaces where artists are sort of at the core.
Okay. Now, what's coming up in as far as people to get discover perhaps dance makers? You've got a show coming up on Thanksgiving, don't you?
Yeah, there's a show on Thanksgiving. Martin Spangberg is showing a work. And then the big sort of thing that we've got coming up is Zoya Smutny is showing sort of the phase two, I guess, if we'll call. She did a work in progress showing this spring of her work, Rosé Porn. And that's going to be November 4th through 7th at our space at Dance Makers.
Okay, now we're about running out of time. Is there anything we missed, Amelia, that you would like to say about Dance Makers? Anything else?
I don't think there's anything that, other than, like, Zoya's show, November 4th to 7th, like, come and see it. The work is great. But nothing that I can think of.
Okay. And the website people should go on to find out more information?
It's dancemakers.org.
That's very simple to know.
Yeah, very simple. And we're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, so there's all those fancy platforms for you to get in touch as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Amelia Earhart, for coming on Evidence.
No problem. Thanks so much, Ted.
You are listening to Evidence here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
I got nothing to prove, you got nothing to lose. I got something to live for, honey. So get out of your seat if you can't stand the heat. Jump out of the beat and jump onto the floor. There's something going down, there's things on the street. This is my time, baby, and this is our time to be free. Something in the air, thank God I can breathe. Cause this is our time, and this is my time to come on. This is our time, and this is my time to come on. This is our time, and this is my time to come on. Little bit this for me. You know it now. Little bit this for me. Little bit this for me. You know it now. Little bit this for me. Oh, there's something to see. If you can get down with me, you can't refuse this and love it, but if only you can believe that it's all in the sound that's shaking this town. It sounds so crazy, but it's all around. There's something going down, there's news on the street. This is my town, baby, and this is our time to be free. Something in the air, thank God I can breathe. This is our time, and this is my time to come on. And this is my time to come on. Saying this is our time, and this is my time to come on. Little bit this for me. You know it now. Little bit this for me. Yeah. Little bit this for me. You know it now. Little bit this for me. Oh, oh, oh. Yeah.
Hi, welcome back to Evidence on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Ted Fox. The song we just went out on was Soul Motivators, Your One Last Chance, and prior to that, Until the Sun Goes Down, again, the Soul Motivators, and prior to that, Jeff Bennett, who actually composes our theme for our show. Up now is Erin Poole, and she's here to talk about the Coleman Lemieux and Company production of Les Parodies Perdues. Welcome. Erin? I guess Erin isn't here. Are you there? Nope. Okay. I will... Hello?
Hello?
Oh, yes, you are there. Gosh,
hi,
lost
I'm here.
Lost in an abyss. I didn't hear you.
I'm here.
Okay,
hello.
Okay. since we got a short time here, I expected you on a little earlier.
I know. I'm so sorry. Yeah. I'm in rehearsal. I'm in my costume.
You're in your costume. Oh, we're going to talk about that.
I'm in my costume right now, yeah.
So it's Les Parodies Perdues. Let's talk about it right off the bat. It's Laurence Lemieux, and it's based on her childhood. Can you talk a bit about the basis for this piece?
Sure. So Laurence choreographed this in 2005, and so we're using this as sort of a remix of the original, and it's inspired by nothing like so dark or nothing so joyous. It's just inspired by the feeling of childhood and sort of the general, you know, the feeling that you have as a child and the excitement and the fear and all the little tiny memories. Mm-hmm. And the little tiny feelings that go along with that. So she's using a lot of her own personal memories in the music score, but there's also room for Luke and I to sort of play with, you know, our own childhood memories and what that means. And we've been developing sort of a different relationship between the two of us than what was originally created by Laurent. So that's been fun. And yeah, so the title suggests, you know, Paradise Lost, and sort of that feeling of, you know, you can never really get back your childhood. It's a very isolated time in your life. You can never actually recreate for yourself. Mm-hmm. So it sounds a little sad, but it's also a really kind of joyful opportunity to just reminisce about that as well.
How does Laurence work with you guys recreating? Are you actually playing, say, children in the way you move, the way you're choreographed?
We have a few different sections, and we have, you know, a different idea for each one. But there is a part where, we are trying to channel that inner child sort of way of moving. Way of thinking what dance is as a child too. There's a little bit of that. So that's a little bit of a surprise, I guess, to the show, but there's...
Yeah. So you're accessing your own memories of what it was like for each of you as children and incorporating them into this.
Yeah, and incorporating it into our body as well, which can be challenging too. Like, it's a challenging task to try and remember, you know, oh, what did I think ballet looked like as a child? Like, you know... trying to erase all the other stuff that you've experienced and just go back to that.
It's interesting because children in their own bodies at a very young age don't have, say, dance here, theater there, all is incorporated in one. So when they play, they're both theaters, actors, they're both children dancing, they're both children doing other art forms. So I find that very interesting.
Yeah, they're just experiencing their bodies in play and in imagination, and there's not that awareness yet of like, oh, do I look silly or does this not make sense? Like, you're just sort of going, you know.
How important are costumes in this, and how are you working with the color and light and?
Yeah. Like I said, I'm in my costume right now.
and it's
really helpful to create the character, I think, for both of us, and to create this little world that we have going on here at the Citadel. It's like, it's a big part of it. There's hats, there's sort of this like Harlequin doll-themed costume. They were designed by Jane Townsend, and they're the same costumes that that were worn in 2005 as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like, you don't often see costumes with this much color. Like, there's yellows and reds and blues and greens, and there's patches, and so I think it's all coming together right now in a very, a very whimsical way. So that definitely helps. And we have these cute little hats, so that affects how I would act as a doll, how I would move as a doll in certain ways.
That's interesting, because the photo you have up on the site, it almost looks like Luke looks like a marionette.
There's that feel.
The feel to it, yes.
Yeah, and there's kind of Harlequin, but like not quite. Like, I think the girl in the Harlequin would normally have a tutu. I don't have a tutu. Like, I'm sort of, we're hybrid Harlequin, meant marionette, doll, children. Some mix.
Yeah. The composer is Christopher Butterfield. He is the original composer for this. Can you describe that?
So Christopher is sort of the third character in our little play, or our little show here. So he actually has quite a big role in sort of, he creates most of the sound. There is a soundtrack, but he is there speaking live, little fragments of Laurence's memories, and also some of, Bill's memories, Bill Coleman's memories. So that's from the original piece. And there is some interaction with him, and he has like a huge personality, and so to interact with him creates this sort of it creates this outside perspective, who's sort of dictating sometimes what's going on in the space, and his voice is so commanding. He does some French and some English. He's a big presence and important, like definitely important to the piece. Yeah.
Now there's text, right?
There's text.
And
yes,
sung and can you describe? I understand there's some play on loss of syllable or something. Or,
oh,
this is what I heard, so I don't know any more than that.
Yeah, it's true. He's created his own score, so you know there were all these memories, and so he has. He drops out certain words, and he has a very specific rhythm that he follows. So sometimes it's very nonsensical, and you just catch little words and little visions here and there, but the rest becomes kind of chaotic. But for him, it's quite set and it's quite rhythmical. And I'm always baffled. I'm like, how is he even remembering which way the words go and this and that? But it's very set for him. But yeah, he drops syllables, he drops words, and then he also sings. He goes in and out of singing and talking and whispering, and very theatrical.
Great. Now, all this is taking place at the Citadel. Describe that space. I really like it. It's intimate and,
It's very intimate, and you can sort of customize it to the show, which is what's really special about it, I think. So, like I said, we're creating this, we're using a bit of a smaller dance space. We have a beautiful white floor, and so the seats are set up in a way that everyone is sort of, it's very centered, like very centered in on the little tiny, play space or area or our little world. So Simon Rossiter is doing the lights, and we're just, we're putting that together now, and it's going to be very, very intimate and very colorful.
The last time I saw you and Laurence was, I think it's a previous piece, and it was on a night in which your piece opened with a thunderstorm, and outside there was a horrendous thunderstorm, and you couldn't tell when you're watching it which was the soundscape and which was real. You probably
remember that
night. It was wild.
I do remember that. Yeah, it was like the two worlds were in sync.
Yeah, I know. That was
quite
memorable.
The streetcars. Yeah,
it's
you can
good,
hear the
good trigger.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, so ColemanLemieux.com would be the site you'd go to, right?
Yes.
And Lemieux is LEMIEUX.com, and you'll get information of box office tickets, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
And thank you, Aaron Poole, for coming on.
Thank you so much, Ted.
Okay, that was Aaron Poole, Paradis Perdu, and October 14th to 17th, 2015, 8 p.m. at the Citadel, 304 Parliament Street. I'd like to thank Baroque dancer Taylor Gledhill talking about the opening of the 30th anniversary season of Opera Atelier, and Amelia Earhart, who's the curator and curator at Dancemakers. And coming up next week, I'm not sure what's coming up next week, actually. However, I'm Ted Fox. Shirav is on tech, and we'll see you next week here on Evidence and CIUT 89.5 FM.
Amalé, me malua.